Welcome to the Economics Explored podcast, a frank and fearless exploration of important economic issues. I'm your host, Gene Tunney. I'm a professional economist and former Australian Treasury official. The aim of this show is to help you better understand the big economic issues affecting all our lives. We do this by considering the theory, evidence, and by hearing a wide range of views. I'm delighted that you can join me for this episode. Please check out the show notes for relevant information. Now on to the show. Hello and welcome to the show. In today's episode, I've got three quite different topics. First, I'll respond to some thoughtful feedback from Maggie, who's a regular listener. She sent me a great note after the recent episode on Australia's record low fertility rate. Maggie raised a series of really important questions about the cost of childcare, about the cost of IVF, and about penalties to women returning to the workforce after childbirth. So I will respond to those questions first, and then we'll head back 2,000 years to ancient Rome. I've been reading Tom Holland's brilliant translation of Suetonius's The Twelve Caesars, or The Lives of the Caesars. Something in the Augustus chapter caught my eye, a passage about interest rates falling because of an influx of money into Rome after Augustus's victory over Antony and Cleopatra at Alexandria. So this is a fascinating economic story that I want to go through and explain how we can think about it in modern economics. So finally, I'll turn to something more modern than ancient Rome. We'll look at a remarkable meeting between Milton Friedman and Ronald Reagan when Ronald Reagan was preparing to run for president. The story comes from Sebastian Mallaby's outstanding biography of Alan Greenspan, The Man Who Knew. It reveals a lot about what Friedman thought about the gold standard and how that conversation shaped Reagan's thinking. I should say that I've received a lot of feedback on the recent episode about gold. There were lots of great questions and comments, and I'll come back to them in a future episode. Meanwhile, please keep the feedback coming. I really appreciate it. A quick word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Lumo Coffee. I drink Lumo myself. I absolutely love it. It's my go-to in the morning. It's organic coffee from the highlands of Peru, rich in antioxidants. Economics Explorer listeners can enjoy a 10% discount. Details are in the show notes. Okay, now let's jump into the episode. Okay, so Maggie from Florida has given me some great feedback on the recent baby bust episode. Maggie, thanks so much for listening, and I really appreciate you reaching out and sharing your thoughts. So Maggie writes, I loved it. I listened to it 2x already and can't wait to watch The Birth Gap on YouTube. So that was a video that John Humphreys and I mentioned in our chat. Maggie writes, I have so many rabbit holes I want you to go down. Why is childcare so expensive, even if we claim to value babies? Why is it women are penalized going into work, into the workforce in their 40s after their kids are old enough to be on their own? Why are there so many singletons? Why is IVF so expensive? And what does the world look like with a smaller population, and why is that bad? Maybe long-term it's healthy. Gee, there lots of questions there. And Maggie writes, speaking as an American that got married at 19, husband and I waited to have babies after 30 because we couldn't afford ourselves. Now at 37, after years of trying, we are going to spend a small fortune on an IVF clinic. Since we can't have a kid on our own, I always wanted three. Now I'll be lucky to have one. We were waiting because we couldn't afford childcare. So we waited because we couldn't afford childcare and the hospital bills in the US. I couldn't leave the job market don't have maternity leave and get paid nothing. We could barely afford our mortgage at the time. Not because we didn't want kids. Love, love, love the podcast. Maggie, thanks for getting in touch and lots of good questions. And I'm thinking of you. I hope the IVF journey works out. So fingers crossed there. Regarding your questions, gee, there's so many good ones there. We'll have to have some future episodes on these topics. On childcare, I mean, the underlying issue is that it's very labour intensive sector, and often we have governments dictating what the staff ratio, so the ratio of staff to children, should be, and that increases costs more than say they would be if those restrictions weren't in place. And we see that I see in Florida there are staffing ratios. I've found a website on that. I'll put a link in the show notes to that. And so they'll have ratios such as, well, for children from birth through to 1 year of age, you have to have one early care and education personnel for every four children. So that's one to four. And then that ratio, the number of children each staff member can look after, increases as the children get older. So for children 3 years of age or older but under four, it's 1 to 15, and then it ends up at 1 to 25 for children 5 years of age or older. And we have similar rules in Australia. I mean, the ratios are probably different. I haven't done a detailed comparison. And we also require particular qualifications. So we require that they have a nationally approved qualification, so at least so that there are things like a Certificate 3, a diploma, or a bachelor degree of higher. So you need to have the right qualification to do the job. And this is something that's going to increase your cost too, because there's fewer people who are eligible to do the job. So that restricts the supply of available labour. Okay, and the other thing to keep in mind is, because it is labour intensive, so there are the regulations that are increasing the costs. There's also the problem that if you've got a productivity sector, a labour intensive sector, then as productivity elsewhere in the economy in a capital intensive sector such as manufacturing or mining, as productivity increases in other sectors and wages get driven up in those other sectors, then your sector, to retain labour, needs to increase its wages too. But the problem is you're not getting the productivity gains that other sectors have. I mean, effectively, the productivity is fixed by those staffing ratios. The government's telling you you need to have this many staff per child, and you can't take advantage of, say, new technology, whether that's surveillance technology to reduce that staffing ratio, or you can't say. I mean, one day we'll have the question of, will we allow robots to look after children? I expect Elon Musk would like his Optimus robot to do something like that. We're not there at the moment, but I mean, maybe one day we'll be asking that question. Maybe that's how we can get some productivity gains in childcare. But for now, we don't seem to be able to get them. And so the costs in real terms in childcare are going to rise faster than in other sectors. So this is called the Bomole cost disease, which is named after the American economist, the late American economist who discovered it, William Bomole, who was professor at, I think he was either Princeton or Columbia, very distinguished American economist. And he first discovered this phenomenon when he did a study for the Metropolitan Opera Company, I think it was, back in the 60s, because they were worried, well, why are our costs going up so fast? Why are is our financial situation, why is it degraded? And it's because of those rising costs, that Bomole cost disease. I'll put some links in the show notes about that. Okay, so that's childcare. That's what's going on there. Now, IVF, why that's so expensive, I don't really have much to say about that. I mean, I expect it's to do with the technology, all of the lab works that is required, the fact that you may need multiple cycles. I think there's some support for IVF from our public health system, our Medicare here in Australia, so we're fortunate in that regard. I'm unsure what the situation is in the United States. I expect there's less public support for it, and hence, you know, it's going to be much more expensive for people using IVF. Don't really have much more to say about that. I'll keep looking into it. In terms of penalties for women re-entering work in their 40s after childbirth, yep, this is a big question. There's a lot of research on the gender pay gap, and it is hard to get your head around. I've had a few conversations on this show, particularly with Leonora Rees, who's one of the top economists, labour market economists here in Australia. She does a lot of work on the gender pay gap, and I'll put links in the show notes to some of my conversations with Leonora, so you can check those out. In addition to referring you to Leonora's to the conversations I had with Leonora, I'll put some links to some recent studies I've found that are I think have some insights. The thing I would say is that, look, it's going to be a combination of things. There's not going to be one single explanation. It's partly going to be due to the fact that you've been out of the workforce for a while, and therefore maybe you've lost touch with your network. Your network is your net worth, as they say. You're not up to date with the latest technologies or latest work practices. There could be those things. That's certainly potentially a factor. There's the fact that, I mean, to an extent, there's a trade-off. So women returning to the workforce, some may choose to take a job which is less stressful, less of a greedy job. So it's more easily adaptable to their circumstances, their need for flexibility, and that's going to limit the pay. It will limit the promotional opportunities. This greedy jobs concept is something, a fascinating concept that I talked about with Leonora in, I think, the most recent chat I had with her on the gender pay gap. So I'll put a link in the show notes to that. That's definitely worth checking out. Okay, so it's a combination of those things. And look, there may still be some, there could be some residual discrimination. I think economists tend to, they don't like those types of explanations because they're not rational, but perhaps there could be some judgment involved. It's hard to rule that out. I would think it's probably a very minor part of it, that there's a bias there, that employers are thinking, well, if a woman, you know, she's coming back after this many years out of the workforce, she won't be as productive as other workers. Maybe that's part of it. I don't know. I don't think it'd be a large part of it because it's not rational. And I mean, the world's changed so much in the last 40 or 50 years. We hope those attitudes still aren't around. Righto, so I will link to a couple of studies I've found. One is a meta-analysis that's published in Social Science Research, which is a reasonably good journal. I think it's Elsevier, so it's an Elsevier journal, which is a good publisher. It publishes the Economic Analysis and Policy Journal that Economic Society of Australia Queensland has. So the study is the Motherhood Wage Penalty, a meta-analysis. And so it looks at 208 wage effects of having exactly one child and 245 wage effects of the total number of children. So it's looked at studies where they've looked at the impact of having one child or multiple children, and the researchers have found that there's an average motherhood wage gap of around 3.6 to 3.8%. So being a mother, having children, that reduces your wages relative to others by 3.6 to 3.8%. Okay, and they find that the gaps associated with the total number of children are mostly explained by the loss of mother's human capital during child-related career breaks. So this is a human capital story I was talking about, the fact that maybe because women are out of the workforce, because they're having children, maybe, you know, things move on, there's new technology, through no fault of their own, because they're having children, obviously, the mothers haven't been able to keep up with that. So there's that aspect of it. They also find that the gaps associated with one child are predominantly driven by mother's choice of jobs and occupations that pay less. So this is this phenomenon that to some extent, women are choosing jobs which are more flexible, which are less stressful, which are less greedy. And so therefore, you know, that's part of the explanation too. Now, the way I think about the fact that for the total number of children, it's mostly explained by the loss of mother's human capital is that if you've got more than one child, then you're spending longer out of the workforce, and therefore you're more that human capital impact, the fact that your skills may, you may not have kept up, or you may have, skills may have depreciated or degraded. I think that's a bigger part of the story. Okay, so that's probably all I can say about the penalty for women returning to work after childbirth for now. We might have to do a deeper dive in a future episode and have a look at further studies. But my feeling is it is related to the phenomenon of, you know, the impact of human capital, and to some extent it's due to choosing an occupation that's more flexible. Say if the woman still needs to take time out to you know, look after children or attend school functions, etc., then that means that they can't have one of these so-called greedy jobs, and it may limit promotional opportunities. So I think that's what's going on there. Righto. So what are some of the other questions? I mean, there's so many good questions, Maggie. The rise of singleton households. This is something that, you know, John and I talked about in our fertility gap, our baby bust episode. It's, again, it's one of these phenomena. It's one of these things that's due to a whole range of factors. It's multidimensional. It's partly to do with rising incomes, the fact that more people can afford to live on their own rather than in share houses. Women have opportunities to leave their husband and live on their own. Certainly no fault divorce, which started coming in the 1970s, first in California and then spreading to other states in the US, in Australia. I think we adopted it in the mid 70s. Certainly that has led to an increase in these singleton households. There's the fact that people are delaying marriage much longer. I mean, the median age of marriage, I should have checked the numbers before I hopped on, but I mean, once upon a time, people got married in their, you know, early 20s. Now people are delaying it until their 30s or even later or not partnering at all. So we've got this delayed partnering that's part of it. On the impact of no-fault divorce, I found something from the US Census Bureau that I'll link to in the show notes. And so it wrote that over a quarter, so 27.6% of all US occupied households were one-person households in 2020, up from just 7.7% in 1940, according to recently released 2020 census data. The share of people living alone increased every decade from 1940 to 1920. The largest increase happened between 1970 and 1980, when the share increased from 17.6% to 22.7%, and that was the decade of when no-fault divorce was made available. And that was really the decade of divorce, wasn't it? That's when you had Kramer versus Kramer. I don't know. Those of us who were old enough will remember that as a very famous movie in the late 70s about a couple going through a very tough divorce. Dustin Hoffman and Meryl Streep. Landmark film. Definitely check that out if you haven't seen it. Righto. Okay. What else? I mean, Maggie, again, there's so many questions. Oh, what a smaller population means. Could it be a good thing? I mean, this is one of those big questions. Economists, I guess there's this view that, economists get concerned if we don't have population growth, because population growth is one of those things that naturally encourages new investment and helps keep the economic motor running. It helps grow the GDP, so to speak. But of course, it's per capita GDP that ultimately matters. That's a point that John makes. And certainly with a smaller population, you could have a higher quality of life. There's a debate about Japan. I've covered this in a previous episode that I'll link to in the show notes. I mean, some people look at Japan and think, isn't it terrible? It's got a declining population, and isn't that terrible for the economy? But then others look at Japan and say, well, things aren't really that bad, and there are some positive things associated with a falling population, with a smaller population. I mean, certainly it's going to reduce congestion. It could reduce pollution, less strain on infrastructure, et cetera. So look, one of those big questions. I'll link to a previous conversation that I've had on that issue in the show notes, so you can check that out. So yeah, some big questions you've asked there, Maggie. I provided some initial thoughts, or the thoughts that can fit into this segment, but I'll keep thinking about them, and we may come back to them in a future episode for some deeper dives. Maggie, again, thanks so much for listening. I really value the fact that you're listening and supporting the show and writing in with some great comments. So yep. Please keep it up. Good on you. Okay, that's the end of this segment, and we shall move on to now talk about the influx of gold and other treasure into ancient Rome and the implications of that. All classes of society regularly benefited from his generosity whenever the opportunity arose for him to display it. Indeed, when he brought the contents of the royal treasury from Alexandria to Rome for his triumph, so plentiful did the supply of money become as a result that interest rates plummeted and land values soared. That is from paragraph 41 of the Augustus chapter, Suetonius's The Lives of the Caesars, or the 12 Caesars, translated by Tom Holland. Tom Holland, of course, is the Rest of History host, and I highly recommend that translation. He really brings that ancient text to life. Now, I was fascinated by that passage when I read it. I wasn't aware of this fact that after Augustus Caesar, then Octavian, after he triumphed over Antony and Cleopatra at Alexandria and brought back all the treasure to Rome, we had this increase in land values and a drop in interest rates. So there are some macroeconomic principles we can discuss as a result of this passage. And I thought this would be a good opportunity to to go over them. Okay, so the first thing to look at is this increase in land values. So there's all of this additional money. So among other things, Augustus granted money. He gave grants to his soldiers as a reward. And so there's extra money circulating in the Roman economy. And we know that there is a link between money and prices. So land values are a type of, you know, they're a form of price, the price for land. And we know that there's this relationship, there's the quantity theory of money that the classical economists talked about, this link between the amount of money, so M, the velocity of money, V, so the amount of times the money supply turns over in a period, in a year typically, that is equal to prices, the level of prices, P, times transactions, the number of transactions, T. So what we have is M times V equals P times T. That's the quantity theory of money. Milton Friedman he wrote a lot about the quantity theory of money and the link between money and prices. It's not a perfect relationship by any means, and indeed in the short run, that quantity V, the velocity, may be variable. It can change, and so hence a change in M, a proportional increase in M, doesn't necessarily lead to a proportional increase in P. That is, if you double the amount of money, you don't end up with prices doubling as a result. However, there is a link, and I'll quote Milton Friedman here about the link. Friedman wrote that there is perhaps no empirical relationship in economics that has been observed to recur so uniformly As Friedman has put it, there is perhaps no other empirical relationship in economics that has been observed to recur so uniformly under so wide a variety of circumstances as the relation between substantial changes over short periods in the stock of money and in prices. The one is invariably linked with the other and is in the same direction. This uniformity is, I suspect, of the same order as many of the uniformities of the physical sciences. Right, so that is Milton Friedman talking about the link between money and prices. Later on, well, there are other passages from Friedman that qualify or provide further explanation of Friedman's views. Friedman was always careful to distinguish the short run and the long run. Now, there's a view amongst some economists, there's this concept of the neutrality of money, that in the long run, money is neutral, that any increase in money should simply flow through to prices and therefore have no real impacts on the economy. It shouldn't change the level of economic activity, the real economic activity, the people in employment, the level of investment, etc. Now, I've got another passage from Friedman that clarifies what Friedman's views on money are. And this is from a great book. I'll link to this in the show notes. It's one of my favorite books on economic theory, and the history of economics is called Economic Theory in Retrospect. It's by Mark Blaug. He was a British economist. He was at the London School of Economics, if I remember correctly. And it's really the comprehensive theory of the history of economic thought. And he really goes into great detail, great explanation of what all of these classical and more recent economists of how they were thinking about economic issues, and he gives all of the references that you need to figure out what's going on, and such great explanations of core economic concepts. I can't recommend this book highly enough. Anyway, we'll go back to what Milton Friedman said about money, the link between money and prices. So Friedman writes, "For most Western countries, a change in the rate of monetary growth produces a change in the rate of growth of nominal income about 6 to 9 months later. The effect on prices, like that on income and output, comes some 12 to 18 months later, so that the total delay between a change in monetary growth and a change in the rate of inflation averages something like 2 years. In the short run, which may be as long as 3 to 10 years, monetary changes affect primarily output. Over decades, on the other hand, the rate of monetary growth affects primarily prices." Okay, so how does that Friedman quote affect our understanding of what happened in ancient Rome when all of this money came into Rome from Alexandria? So all of this gold, silver, bronze. So we remember that ancient Rome, or at least in this period and in the early empire, had a tri-metallic monetary system, so gold, silver, and bronze. So how did this influx of treasure affect the Roman economy? So what Friedman was saying is that in the short run, it can be the case that this additional money, it doesn't all show up immediately in price increases. It can actually have some real impacts on the economy. So it's not as if you double the money supply, then you double prices because you've got, all of these people have got extra money, and then they're all sort of still trying to buy the same goods and services that are being produced, and they all get bid up in price. You don't have additional goods and services being created. Now, what can happen in the short run is that it can take time for those prices to increase, or it could be the case that people hoard the money, or they don't go out and spend it all at once. There's a drop in the velocity of money. So recall we talked about that quantity theory of money, the MV equals PT. So that's one thing that can change. You don't necessarily see prices responding immediately to money. There can be a real impact of the money on the economy. You could get additional output, or you could get a drop in velocity of money because people want to hold on to the money. They're trying to rebuild or repair their balance sheets, as we say today, or they're trying to get their household back into shape. Perhaps in that period after the Civil War, that was a motivation. People wanted to rebuild their money stocks, or they wanted to make sure that they had plenty of money. They weren't going to go out and spend it all at once. So you don't necessarily get the prices increasing straight away. That's what Friedman was saying. And I think we notice that in this period, so in this period in Rome. So what I find fascinating about this quote from Suetonius, is that you see land values increasing. So there is some price effect. So you've got some wealthy people who've got hold of this money, or these soldiers who've got all of this money from Augustus as a gift. I mean, I'm sure he was, spreading the wealth around, and there'd be people who get hold of this money, and one place to put money, or the one thing to invest in is, if you're not ready to spend the money on goods and services, is land. You could buy some land, and so that has pushed up the price of land. But at the same time, we know that all of the increase in money that has been seen, the proportional increase in the money supply that occurred in Rome, it didn't all flow through to prices or push prices up by the same proportion. And we know that because interest rates plummeted, and they plummeted a lot. If you look at another source, so I'll explain this in a moment, what the mechanism is, but if you look at another source, there's another historian of that period. He wrote a history of Rome, ancient Rome, and he wrote about Augustus, Cassius Dio, and this is from his history of the years of Augustus. And Cassius Dio wrote that so vast an amount of money, in fact, circulated through all parts of the city alike, that the price of goods rose, and loans for which the borrower had been glad to pay 12% could now be had for one-third that rate. So 12% borrowing rate falls to 4%. What that means is that there has been a large increase in the real volume of money, in the what economists call real money balances. So it hasn't been the case that the proportional increase in the money supply has simply been reflected immediately in a proportional increase in prices, which would mean in that case, well, there's no real increase in the amount of money. There's no, the money isn't worth anything more in real terms. But in this case, it is worth more in real terms. The value, the volume of money, the amount of money that's out there has increased. So there's more money in real terms. And what we know is that the demand for money, so this gets a bit wonkish. Those of you who've studied economics or macroeconomics, and you'd be familiar with Keynes's work on liquidity preference, you'd be familiar with how that's expressed in the celebrated ISLM model from John Hicks. You understand that the demand for money is the demand for real balances. Now, if that hasn't changed, if people still want to hold the same amount of money in real terms, but the amount, the supply of money in real terms increases because we've got this large growth in the amount of money in nominal terms, the amount of gold and silver coins and bronze coins floating around in Rome, if we've got an increase in that, but prices haven't risen by proportionally as much, then the real value of that money has, or the real volume of money, the real supply of money is larger. So there's an increase in supply for the same demand. That's going to drive down the interest rate. So because in order for people, the way to think about it is, if you think about it, the way that the only reason people would hold that extra amount of money in real terms is if the opportunity cost of holding that money, which is represented by the interest rate, is lower. So what we see is that the increase in the real money supply has pushed down the rate of interest. So that's a sign that the money increase, this monetary shock that ancient Rome has experienced, that it had real impacts in the short term, that money wasn't neutral, that it had this impact on potentially on the real economy, because if borrowing is cheaper, then people will borrow. I mean, look, some of them probably may have borrowed to buy the land, and that's the reason the land value soared. That's part of what's going on there. But it could have been that they borrowed to, I don't know, upgrade their villa or their mansion. And so it could have had real impacts on the economy. But I don't have any evidence. I haven't read any sources that have talked about that. If you know of them, if you're a classic scholar, then please get in touch. Let me know. If you think I've got something about the interpretation of what's happening in ancient Rome wrong, then let me know too. But I thought this was a really good illustration of a monetary shock and how in the short run it can have real effects on the economy. It will have some impact on prices, but there won't be a full pass-through, so to speak. It won't be completely neutral on the economy, because you just won't have prices immediately doubling if, say, the money supply doubled. I think that's a really good illustration of that phenomenon. And if you've got any thoughts on that, any questions, any clarifications, if you think I've messed something up in my understanding of what happened in that incident, please let me know. Get in touch. As usual, I would love to hear from you. Righto. So again, I can't recommend highly enough that translation of Suetonius's The 12 Caesars or The Lives of the Caesars. Check it out. It's available from all good bookstores and I'm reading it on Kindle. Actually, I'm listening to it on Audible too. So Tom Holland does the intro on Audible, and you know, it's worth getting just for that introduction read by Tom Holland. He's obviously a brilliant man, brilliant podcaster. Righto, so that's the end of another segment. And in the next segment, we will talk about Milton Friedman's views on the gold standard. Before we wrap up, I want to go back to this question of the gold standard, whether it would make sense to go back to a gold standard where a particular amount of money would be backed by a certain amount of gold. And theoretically, you would have a right to that gold if you handed over the right amount of money to the bank. There are a lot of particularly libertarian economists who would like to go back to the gold standard. Indeed, in my conversation with John Humphreys in our recent chat, John argued for returning to the gold standard. I'm sympathetic to that view, because I do recognize, as the libertarian economists do, or as many economists do, that there is a risk that governments can turn on the printing press to pay their bills. They can use inflation to try to reduce the real value of the debts that they owe. If you use the printing press too much, of course, you can end up with inflation, or you could end up even with hyperinflation, as you see in some Latin American countries or in Zimbabwe at times. There's always that risk, and hence something like a gold standard is attractive. However, it's probably impractical, and that was the point I tried to make when I had that conversation with John. And to illustrate that, I pointed out that Ronald Reagan was considering introducing a gold standard during his presidential run in 1980, or in the late 70s, 1980, before he was elected. And to understand whether that would be sensible, he consulted with none other than Alan Greenspan, later Federal Reserve Governor, very famous man, and also with Milton Friedman, one of the greatest of the 20th century economists. I mean, one of the greatest economists of all time, really, when you think about it. And both Greenspan and Friedman said that returning to the gold standard was impractical. You couldn't do it. It wouldn't make sense. And I'll tell this story from this great book by Sebastian Mallaby, The Man Who Knew the Life and Times of Alan Greenspan. So this is about 10 years old now, this book. It was shortlisted for the FT McKinsey Business Book of the Year Award in 2016. And I'd highly recommend this book. It's got this great story about how Reagan consulted with both Greenspan. He met Greenspan at Marina Del Rey, which is an affluent corner of Los Angeles wedged between the bohemia of Venice Beach and the brutish utilitarianism of the city's international airport. And Reagan wondered whether there should be a return to gold. So could we reestablish a monetary standard of or discipline, the candidate asked in his mellow voice. For instance, could we coin $200 gold pieces from the Fort Knox reserves? Reagan evidently associated Nixon's break with the gold standard with ruinous inflation. He wanted to go back to the old verities. So that's from Sebastian Mallaby's book. So Reagan asks Greenspan this, and Greenspan bluntly tells him, "You are reversing cause and effect. We went off the gold standard because the printing of money increased and inflation developed." So what Greenspan was saying is that, as Mallaby writes, inflation had forced the country off the gold standard, not the other way around. So it wasn't the case that the country went off, the US went off the gold standard or abandoned Bretton Woods, and then inflation came about. No, the inflation was happening already, or it was building up already. I think that's a very good point. And you know what Greenspan then told Reagan was that we must resolve the fiscal and inflation problems. If we can do that, there is no need to return to the gold standard. And I think that's a very good point. So the point he's making is that the critical thing is to get your budget in order, to get control of your money supply, to have a central bank that is ensuring that the money supply doesn't grow too fast, that it's in line with how the economy's growing, that you've got interest rates being set at the right level, whatever that is. I mean, we can talk about that in another episode. And even if you have a gold standard, I mean, there's no guarantee that that will happen. So it's not the gold standard that's actually the critical thing. The critical thing is having a sensible fiscal and monetary policy. So very, very good point from Alan Greenspan. It's all about getting your budget under control, so you're not actually having to print money and creating inflation. So a brilliant point from Greenspan. And then there's another story in this book, The Man Who Knew, about Reagan's consultation with Milton Friedman. And this was in January 1980 and January 21st, which was the day on which the gold price hit its all-time high, its then all-time high. Reagan huddled in earnest discussion with Friedman at the candidate's nondescript Los Angeles headquarters at 9841 Airport Boulevard, rather than a marina and a sea of fancy yachts, so where he met Greenspan in that earlier story. So the view from Reagan's office featured aircraft hangars rather than the fancy yachts. And Reagan asked, what if we announced a plan to mint and sell gold? If Americans had gold coins in their pockets, they would feel confident that the government would not expropriate their wealth by engineering inflation. That was Reagan's logic. And Friedman told him that gold is an unstable basis for a monetary system. The gold price had leapt from $550 an ounce at the start of January to $850 at the time of their meeting. And to Friedman, that was proof that gold was, as Malaby describes it, a fickle store of value. And Friedman told him that the gold bandwagon is a false path. The key to fighting inflation is to hold down monetary growth and control the budget. So that is Milton Friedman reinforcing Alan Greenspan's point. I mean, Greenspan probably gave Friedman a heads up on what Reagan wanted to talk about, and so they probably conferred on that point. They're both saying the same thing, and I think that's the critical point. So another book, among a few that I've recommended this episode, that I'd suggest you check out, particularly if you're interested in this whole question of fiat money versus something like a gold standard. I think it's one of these things we're going to be talking about. I think as long as we've got an economy, as long as we've got money, we'll still be having this discussion, this debate. All right. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. We've covered quite a few different topics. I thought, rather than covering just a single topic this episode, because I had a backlog of issues I wanted to cover based on your feedback and things I've been thinking about, I thought it'd be good to have a few different topics in some different segments. So if you like that structure, then please let me know. Any other feedback, definitely get in touch. You can email me at gene.tunney@gmail.com. I look forward to your company in a future episode. Thanks so much for listening.